Travel presented by Vintage Guitar Magazine with your host, me, James Patrick Regan, otherwise known as Jimmy from the Deadlies. And today I'm speaking with the blues doctor, Stacy Mitchhart. In our conversation, Stacy talks about his home in Nashville, where he's lived for the past 30 years, and the club where he's had a residency for the same 30 years, Bourbon Street Blues and Boogie Bar. Stacy tells us about his new album, No Rhyme or Reason, which is out now, and Stacy takes us through his musical education and his hometown of Cincinnati, and he explains the moniker Blues Doctor, and he tells us about his dad's record collection, which heavily inspired his musical direction, and he talks about a group of musical friends who have remained close throughout his career. Stacy discusses his guitar collection and his relationship with Epiphone and his endorsements with Vintage Guitars and Ciari Guitars. And he tells us about how he deals with gear when he's touring overseas and how he fills out his band internationally as well. Stacy describes releasing albums independently throughout his career and crowdfunding before there was the internet. And he also talks about being self-managed. Finally, Stacy talks about his Cadillacs that he restored. To find out more about Stacy, you can go to his website, stacymitchhart.com. That's stacymitchhart.com. Please subscribe, like, comment, share, and most of all, review this podcast. I'd really appreciate it. And please support Vintage Guitar Magazine and all the wonderful things they do for us guitar players, because they do so many wonderful things for us guitar players. Oh, and hey, if you want to support the show, you can support me on patreon.com/haveguitarwilltravelpodcast. Here's my buddy Stacy.
Oh, we got lucky.
Yeah, it's nice nice to meet you, Stacy. Where are you at exactly?
I'm at home in Nashville.
Okay. How long have you lived in Nashville?
30 years.
Wow. You're an early arriver.
Well, the venue that I have a residency at brought me here 30 years ago. I've been playing that venue for 30 years.
What venue is that?
It's called Bourbon Street Blues and Boogie Bar.
Okay. And it's right there in Lower Broadway?
No. It's in Printer's Alley, a couple blocks away.
Okay.
Anybody who lives here, you never go to Broadway unless somebody comes in from out of town and they force you to go. Yeah.
Well, you might want to go to Roberts.
Well, that's the only place I go.
Okay.
Because I have to get the recession special.
Yes, of course. Do you still drink?
Yeah, I have some beverages from time to time.
Right on. Okay, good. Glad to hear it. What's the title of the new album?
No Rhyme or Reason.
No Rhyme or Reason. Right on. It's fantastic. When I get it, I don't have the title.
Right.
They just send me the file. It's fantastic.
So I love it. You're one of the guys that'll let you send files. There's so many that are like, we got to have the CD. I'm like, who does CDs anymore? You know.
Nobody. I can honestly say nobody does CDs anymore. You can sell them at shows. They're good for souvenirs.
Yeah, there you go. Well, I tell people all the time, I'm like, we realize a lot of people don't own a CD player anymore, so tonight you can get a special. You can get three beautiful coasters for $20 and check your fine furniture with my music, you know.
Where were you living before you moved to Nashville 30 years ago?
Cincinnati, my hometown.
Okay. And were you must have been playing there, too, of course.
Of course, yeah.
Yeah.
I was doing... You know, I was playing there full time. I've always been a full time musician. Uh-huh. You know, ever since I got it, even when I was in college, supposed to be going to classes. You know, but I was, but it's all I've ever done. And I was playing Cincinnati, and then then we kind of bounced out a couple hours away, uh-huh. Columbus, yeah. Indianapolis, Dayton, stuff like that. And I just wanted to, Louisville, Lexington. I wanted to add another city and go a little further. And I had a friend that lived in Nashville, so I came down, stayed with him, and just checked places out.
Uh-huh.
This place was getting ready to open, so then I came back a few months later and sat in with their house band, booked a couple gigs, and then after the second time there, they said, it's too bad you don't live here because we're getting ready to fire our house band, and we would love it if you would come. And I said, well, make me an offer. And so it's worked out very well.
How do they feel about you playing at places like Third and Lindsay?
You know, the original ownership, I wouldn't have been able to do that, but the original ownership, I was there 5 days a week. And so they wanted to make it like exclusively, I couldn't play anywhere else within about an hour, hour and a half radius.
Uh-huh.
You know, I could still tour places I'd played before, but the current ownership, and the city's a little different too, but I do 3 days in a residency that are all weekdays.
Uh-huh.
And so for me, you know, they said I can play anywhere else in town I want to, uh-huh. you know, just fill it out. But because the majority of the time on the weekends I go out on the road somewhere. But this Third and Lindsay thing, it's on a day that I normally would be at Bourbon Street.
Yep.
But because they're doing like a live radio broadcast and they're doing a streaming.
Okay.
And we're anticipating having probably 350, 400 people there, and Bourbon Street is capacity like 207.
Okay.
So, and you know, for video and all that stuff, the sideline, it's just a better venue for what we're doing.
Sure.
And
sure.
They understand and they were cool with it, you know. Yep.
Do they still call you Dr. Blues?
Blues Doctor.
Blues Doctor.
sometimes, yeah. That, interesting story how I got that.
How? You know? Tell me.
I was playing in Atlantic City.
Okay.
And with behind this guy, and he was almost like the Bill Murray lounge singer dude.
Sure.
You know? You know, like, and, you know, he used to dye his chest hairs. And but, I mean, but I learned a lot from him from an entertainment standpoint because he was a great entertainer.
Uh-huh.
But the guy that played drums for him was like the original drummer for Frankie Valli and the Four Seasons.
Oh, wow.
And this guy was just a phenomenal drummer, and we got to be good friends. And he was that guy that he had his tuxedo on, and but the clip-on bow tie was just kind of hanging to the side, you know, and cigarette out of his mouth, you know. And there would be days he said, man, I feel like crap today, man. And you got up and did some blues, and it was just like medicine for me. He says, I'm calling you the blues doctor.
And right,
I said, I'll take that, man. Yeah, I'll take that. And the guy I played for was like, man, stop playing that. Because I would open his shows for him.
Okay.
And he would be like, stop playing that blues, man. You're going to make people sad. I go, man, they're responding very well. So I mix it in with like some Al Jarreau and George Benson. And I do two songs. I do that, and then I do a Bobby Bland, you know. And,
yeah.
And or a B.B. King, and it would work out. You know?
Oh, right on. Right on. So when did you first discover guitar?
I started taking lessons when I was 9.
Okay. And that's in Cincinnati?
The first records I remember hearing were my dad's Wes Montgomery and Johnny Smith records.
Okay. All right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
God.
Did your dad play guitar?
I taught him.
All right.
Oh. That was the deal. After a year, you know, I had a rental guitar, right?
Uh-huh.
And because they, like any other 9-year-old kid, are they really going to stick with it?
Sure,
you know?
sure.
And my parents were not the kind that's just going to blow money for nothing. You know, my mother wouldn't allow that. So after about 6-7 months, my dad said, it looks like you're doing well. Do you want to keep at it? I said, yeah. He goes, okay, I'll make you a deal. I'll buy you a guitar. I'll continue to pay for your lessons, but you have to teach me.
Oh, right on.
And then he bought a Yamaha classical guitar for like $85.
Yeah.
And I've still got that. It's in my living room.
Oh, right on.
I play it every once in a while, man. You know. And
what kind of guitar did he buy you?
So that was the deal, and he did pretty well.
Yeah. What kind of guitar did he buy you?
Fender Mustang.
Oh, okay. Right
on. It was used.
Yeah, what year? What year?
Well, that would have been, that would have been in about 69. So it was probably 63, 64, 65,
yeah.
Somewhere in there.
Okay.
I mean, of course, you know, and I've gone back saying, man, I'd like to have a guitar just like that again. And I'm like, man, they want a lot of money for those.
Right? Oh, yeah, exactly. And the two records they had that you mentioned, what were those again?
Wes Montgomery.
Yeah.
It was called... I think it was just called Bumpin'.
It
was called Moving West was the name of the record. It had Caravan on it and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And the other one was Johnny Smith.
Mm-hmm.
And Johnny Smith had a you know, that Gibson made a Johnny Smith model.
Yeah, of course.
And I actually got to play one of the Wes Montgomery guitars that Gibson made for him.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, that was like I was like, oh my God, you know, there were three that they made for him, and they had this little, cause he, you know, he didn't use a pick. He kind of played like this, and
yeah.
he wore a little hole. So there was like a pearloid thing put in that was the shape of a guitar pick.
Okay.
And so there was only three of them. And some guy, he was from Indianapolis. Some guy from Indy found this guitar that had been in a fire in like some like antique shop.
Okay.
And he bought it. And he started, you know, he sent a thing to Gibson to find the history of the guitar because he knew it was a Gibson. And they found the serial number. And they said that was one of the three guitars that we made for West Montgomery.
Wow.
And they said, if we will completely refurbish it back to new, if you let us keep it for a year and put it on tour.
Oh, wow.
And then after that, we'll give it back to you, and we'll restore it free of charge. And so a friend of mine was like the general manager of the custom shop at the time at Gibson. He called me. He goes, man, I was down there, and they were doing a guitar for me. And he's like, I got something I want to show you. And he had no idea that I was a huge West Montgomery fan.
Sure.
And he told this, and I'm like, oh, my God. I sat and played it. And, of course, the first thing I did was try to play Bumpin' on Sunset, you know, my favorite West Montgomery. And it was just like, it was, oh. I got to play that. Some guy brought me a guitar that had been Freddie King's 345, and I played that once, and that was pretty cool. I mean, just you know, that's guitar geek stuff. You know,
sure. That's what we are. Yeah. We're all geeks.
Yeah, exactly.
and so did you? Were you? When was the first time you got into a band? Was it in high school or junior high?
No, junior high. There was a talent show, and me and this other kid had we were studying history or something. We were in history class, and we wrote a song called "Constitutional Rights." That's what I'm talking about. It's probably a pretty bad song, but we were in—I think I was in sixth or seventh grade—and we put a little band together and we played it on the show.
Uh-huh.
And then my first actual band, I was. Like going into ninth grade.
Okay.
And the guys that I played with, we ended up playing together from then all the way up until the end of my freshman year of college.
Wow.
We were band. And in fact, the coolest thing, this past weekend, we talk all the time anyway. They're literally like my brothers. I'm only child. They were my brothers, and their family was my family, and vice versa.
Sure.
And, man, we kept talking to my one, and the one guy that lives in L.A. is like, man, I got to get out of L.A. And I was like, well, man, come to Nashville for a couple days, and we'll go down and hang with this other friend of ours that's playing in Puerto Rico that I hooked up for a gig. And so he was doing that, and his brother lives in Cincinnati, so he was going to come down. And then we all sat there, and then I got a phone call, and they wanted me to come play the Juke Joint Festival down in Clarksdale.
Okay.
And I'm like, okay. So I called Eddie and Billy, and I'm like, man, instead of going to Puerto Rico, what do you think about going to Clarksdale, Mississippi? And they're like, what the heck's going on there? And I said, well, look it up. And they looked and said, man, that sounds like, it looks like it'd be more fun.
Yeah.
And plus we were doing a show. So we went down, and this just happened like 2 weekends ago.
Oh,
man,
wow.
We had a ball. We were there for 3 days. We used a friend of mine's tour bus, and that's where we stayed because there's not many accommodations down there. We parked at the campground. We were cooking breakfast. We had a ball, man.
Oh, right on.
And we all said, man, we can't wait this long to do this kind of stuff. But normally, we see each other for 5 or 6 hours maybe at some time in crossing, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah, of course.
It was amazing.
Yeah.
Loved.
So when you're in that band in ninth grade, were you playing that Mustang still?
No, by then, let's see. By then, I probably, the first new guitar I ever bought was a Tele.
Uh-huh.
And so I might have been playing that, or the first guitar I ever bought of my own was a 335 style a Baldwin guitar.
Sure.
And the funny thing about that is I told my wife years later, I'm like, man, I'd really like to just get a Baldwin like that again, just to hang on the wall. Uh-huh. But man, they're wanting $1,500, $2,000 for it. And I said, you know, I just don't, you know, it's there, but I just don't want to blow it on that right now. And so she kept that in the back of her mind, and she's great at getting the perfect gifts for you, you know. And uh-huh. And she reached out to some guy that had shown that he had a like a collection, and he had a red Baldwin 706 in the collection.
Wow.
And she sent him a message and asked if he would sell it. And he said, no, I really don't want to sell it. And then she told him this story. Well, she got the story completely wrong, right? She's telling him that was the first guitar I ever had and that it got stolen from me.
Okay.
And that my dad had bought it. Well, the real story about the stolen guitar was I had found a guitar in a pawn shop much years later and put $100 on it. And my dad, for my birthday, went down to the pawn shop and paid the other $150 or whatever.
Yeah.
And that guitar got stolen.
Okay.
And so Anyway, so the guy dies, and his wife is going through his emails and sees his emails back and forth to my wife. And she reaches out to her and says, look, my husband passed, and I'm going to be moving some of these guitars, and I read your thing, and I really want you to have this. And she sold it to her for like $750.
Oh, right on.
And so then you know, she gives it to me, and I'm like, oh, my God, you know, I can't believe you found this.
Yeah.
And, you know, the first couple years that Baldwin, you know, they bought it from Burns Guitars, right?
Yeah, of course.
And the first 2 years, they were using all the Burns parts, and then after that, they used, like, cheaper, you know, Baldwin parts or whatever.
Yeah.
So the one I bought, I'm sure, was the later Baldwin, because it was just painted red and all that. So this particular guitar has like a red stain, you know, it's you can see the wood.
Yeah.
And I looked at and I took it to somebody to get it, you know, set up, and they go, dude, do you know what you got here? And I go, what do you mean? He goes, this is serial number 12.
Oh, wow.
So I'm like, wow, okay, cool. So I got really lucky. So yeah. You can kind of see it's the last red guitar hanging back there.
Sure.
Yeah. Anyway, it's cool, and it feels great. The electronics are kind of weird in it, so yeah. I don't take it out very often. But God, I just love a real small neck.
Yeah.
And so because I do a lot of grabbing with my thumb and stuff, and it just makes it easy.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, man.
And what about amps back then? What were you using for amps?
First amp I had after I got the Mustang. Well, my dad said, I'm not buying you an amp. You have to plug into the stereo, and you can't play it more than above 3. Yeah. And when he wasn't there, I'd play it at 9, you know. then from the same guy I bought the guitar from, later on we went back, because he was like an extended family member, cousin of a cousin kind of thing.
Sure.
And so I had probably a mid-60s Deluxe Reverb.
Oh, right on.
And then from there, I've always kind of been a Fender guy.
Yeah.
From there, I bought a Twin. And then when I was in high school, you know, I had the Twin with the two 12-inch JBLs in it. And then I had a cabinet with four 12-inch JBLs.
Wow. Underneath
it. So you had that stack sitting behind you, you know.
Yeah.
And we hauled everything in a Volkswagen bus.
Oh, you know? My goodness.
Like, it's like the stuff that I had then, if I had it in great condition right now, man, I'd be retired just cashing it. I mean, the Volkswagen bus alone is worth like $80,000 or $90,000.
Exactly. Exactly. And what college did you go to?
I went to Bowling Green State University in Ohio, by Toledo.
Yeah, yeah. And what were you studying?
Girls.
Yeah.
Girls and guitar. I started in marketing.
Okay.
And I realized after my first summer of college, I got hired to play in the country western band at the amusement park.
Okay.
Near Cincinnati, Kings Island.
Yeah.
And we did six 30-minute shows a day, 6 days a week, the same exact show.
Wow.
And at the end, for like 3.5-4 months, right? And at the end of that summer, I said, man, if I still love music after this, that's what I need to do.
Yeah.
So I made a decision at that point in time that I was either going to play music for a living, have my own music store, or be like a artist management or something like that, a booking agent for a living. But it was going to be in music.
Yeah.
And so I went to the dean of the business school, and I said, you know, this is what I want to do, and what I really want is more of a personal business degree as opposed to a marketing degree or statistics or, you know, whatever, business administration. And she was like, well, we don't really have that kind of degree. And I said, well, can't we tailor make something? I mean, the idea of coming to college is to learn the things you need to succeed in life, you know?
Yeah.
And she didn't really like my smart ass comment. And she said, well, what you need to do is go to communications college and get a communications degree and then just take your electives in business. Which is basically what I did.
Okay.
And so, I mean, my electives, I was taking things like the physics of sound and recording engineering classes and theater lighting, as well as, some finance stuff, which I obviously didn't learn much. I've blown through way too much money over the years. But, But you know, it did me well. You know, I learned a lot. I'm 8 credit hours short of graduation. I kept flunking Spanish because you had to have a foreign language to graduate in the arts and sciences.
Absolutely.
And which is, it's all different now. I mean, we're talking like 19. I was there 78 through like 82 or something like that.
Okay. So you but just you
I
just,
had enough for major and minor. A major in communications, a minor in business, but I kept flunking Spanish. So yeah. It's like, and finally, I'm just like, I don't need the paper. I'm sure my mother wasn't too thrilled about that, but I don't need the paper to do what I'm going to do.
Yeah.
You know, so, and me and my buddy that I worked with in college playing, he was the guy we were going to go see in Puerto Rico, actually. That's,
okay.
We're still as close of friends to all these years later, man. Yeah. And he and I both just said, you know what? We're done. We're out of here. And we moved to Cincinnati for a few months. We moved out to California. We worked within 3 weeks. We were playing 6 days a week.
In California?
In California. But it was all like Orange County stuff, you know. But I had family out there, so we had somewhere to stay.
Okay,
and we were out there for like a year. And then we started getting phone calls from some concert venues in Cincinnati to open up for people. And God, I did 2 shows with Dave Mason. I saw he just died.
Oh, yeah, he just passed away. Yeah.
Yeah, man.
It's so, a couple questions. When you're playing in the amusement park, was it polyester suits?
Oh yeah, God! I wish I had the picture handy, man. It was like polyester bell-bottom pants, the polyester shirt with all the rhinestones up in here, cowboy hat. We weren't allowed to have facial hair.
Okay.
family thing.
Yeah.
And cheap cowboy boots. Yeah, that was us. And belts with a big buckle. You know.
Yeah. What was the set list like?
I think we did 2 or 3 full songs. Everything after that was kind of like medley type stuff. But
sure.
We did Orange Blossom Special.
Yeah.
We did, my song to sing was King of the Road.
Uh-huh.
We did, I'm sure we did Rocky Top.
All kind of country pop kind of stuff.
Yeah, we did, Southern Nights that Glenn Campbell had done.
Of course.
Here You Come Again, Dolly Parton.
Yep.
God, I don't know if I can remember any of the other ones.
But that's,
I mean,
fine.
It was popular in country at the time.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, right on. That's great. And California, going to Orange County, were you playing at Knott's Berry Farm there, or where were you playing in Orange County?
No. It was an acoustic duo.
Okay.
That we were. And so we were playing, we played down in Newport Beach, a place that's still there called The Cannery.
Uh-huh.
We played out in Riverside, a place called Carlos O'Brien's. We played in Huntington Beach at a place called the Rusty Scupper. I don't think that's there anymore.
Yeah.
We played somewhere down there. I think it was called Elmer's down in like Fullerton.
Sure.
I think it was Fullerton. And then we played some other place up in Covina. We were staying in West Covina. I had family there.
Okay.
But it was all little, you know, restaurants and mostly restaurant lounges, stuff like that.
Yeah.
But, I mean, we were making good money, and we worked right away. We found an agent,
wow.
You know, and we went to his office, and he did a video of us playing. And then this guy would go in to meet with a manager of a club with one of those little TVs that had the VHS in it, and he'd pop that in and show the guys 6 different bands, you know, and the guys say, okay. And so we worked right away, which was very fortunate, but it became really obvious to us right away. We weren't playing or doing the right kind of things to become stars and recording and all that other kind of stuff. So we had fun, though.
And at what point did you turn back to the blues?
Going back to the very beginning, my best friend's parents that I played with, their parents, their dad was, he poured cement in the daytime, but he was a preacher and had a small storefront church basically down in the ghetto in Cincinnati.
Okay.
Maybe 40, 50 people in the congregation.
Sure.
And we were his band for church.
Okay.
So he played guitar.
Uh-huh.
He basically played blues guitar and preached gospel.
Yeah, yeah.
And sang gospel. So we were his band. So we had to learn Oh Happy Days for him.
Yeah.
And then their mother was a big B.B. King fan. We had to learn Thriller's Gone for her.
Okay.
And they took me to my first, the first concert I went to that I picked was Lou Rawls.
Okay.
And that, my parents took me there. That was in eighth grade. But they took us to see B.B. King and Bobby Bland together.
Oh, right on.
And Bobby Bland's still my all-time favorite. And my all-time favorite record is B.B. King and Bobby Bland together again for the first time. I think
yeah,
or something.
Yeah.
Great record. And so that, you know, I was always into blues from that time.
Sure.
The country thing, it was just the gig, right?
Yeah.
You know, being able to play, you know, and do that. And then the duo thing we had, it was great. We did stuff. We did, like, Fogelberg and America.
Okay.
And then we'd do some Who, and then we would and then we do, like a duo acoustic version of Breezin' by George Benson, and we might do a Jarosa song. We did a little, and then we'd do Thrill Is Gone by B.B. King and something else. So we kind of did whatever we wanted, and we both played guitar. He played a little piano. I played bass. We both sang. Uh-huh. It was actually a really, really good, you know, duo. But then when I came back home, we still worked together. And then after a few years, I wanted to do there were some things that went on, but I wanted to do kind of more what I'd grown up with, more kind of contemporary jazz, R&B, blues. Uh-huh. And I put a band together doing that. And then I moved to I got married, moved to Philadelphia.
Okay.
Was up there for a few years. And when I was in Philly, my wife was an opera singer.
Oh, wow.
And she was studying with a lady up in the Upper East Side in New York, in Manhattan.
Uh-huh.
And when she would go there, I would go down to, like, Tower Records in the Village. And back then, you would pick out the songs you wanted, and they would make a cassette tape for you. So it was like a mixtape,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And so I went, and I'm seeing all these. I just started making mixtapes of blues.
Yeah, yeah.
And catching stuff, and then started buying, like, because I was aware of the bigger guys. I mean, hell, I saw Muddy Waters once and stuff like that. But I wasn't aware of, like, at that time, I didn't know who Albert King or Albert Collins was.
Sure.
You know, I'd seen Albert King, but I didn't know who Albert Collins was. I didn't know who a couple of the other guys were.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, I would just put stuff on, and then I go back after, if I like the song, then I go back and buy their whole CD or tape or whatever.
Yeah.
And so when I left Philly, I was doing some blues up around there. And then when I left there, I decided, you know, I'm like close to 40 years old. No, I must have been 30. Okay. Yeah, I was close to 30 years old.
Okay.
And I'm like, okay, I'm old enough now where maybe somebody will take me half serious, you know, instead of being like a kid. Like, you know, now if you're a kid and a kid phenom, that they latch onto that.
Sure, sure.
Before, back then, it was like, yeah. Well, you know, that kind of thing.
Uh-huh.
And it's cool because I still have some recordings from back then that I listened to. And I was like, I was actually playing pretty well.
You yeah. know?
I was like, I surprised myself sometimes. Like, damn, I wonder if I can still do that lick, you know. So,
yeah.
But yeah, that's so 90 is when I put the blues band together, going into 91.
Okay. Wow. So
did my first record, my first CD in 92.
Uh-huh.
With that, it was called Blues Transfusion.
Yep.
Going with the Blues Doctor theme,
uh-huh.
you know. And
what label was that on?
I've pretty much always put stuff out on my own label.
Really?
There's only one record I did on another label, and it was a label out of England.
Okay.
And we kind of partnered on it, but, you know.
It's that business degree pays off.
I guess. You know, you realize pretty quickly that, you know, if you can find the financing, you can do it yourself.
Sure.
You know, and I'll tell you what, looking back, I crowdfunded before people were crowdfunding. Back in those days in 92, you collect everybody's address, not their email address or address.
Yeah.
And every month I'd go carrying this big bucket worth of mailers to the post office and mail them out.
Yeah.
And so when I was doing the record, I mailed out a thing and said, hey, I'm doing this record. I need a little help. If you want to buy it up front, send me a check.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I'll put your name on the inside of the whole thing. Anyway, record cost me $14,000 to make, including manufacturing and everything at that time for like 1,000 units. I raised like almost $8,000.
Wow.
So it's like, I was like, you know, that's pretty cool,
yeah.
you know? And, But when I moved to Nashville, I moved here, and the first night I played was a Tuesday night, and I sold 24 CDs.
Oh, wow.
First night I played here and made like $400 in tips in the bucket, right?
Yeah.
And I tell people all the time, I didn't even sell 24 CDs at my CD release party at my first CD in Cincinnati. I said, I didn't know what was going on here, but I knew I think I better be here, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so now you favor, I see the guitar's on the beat right behind your head, but is your main guitar a 335 sort of style?
I don't really have a main.
Okay.
I counted yesterday. I have 30 instruments. I got a couple lap steels. I got, you know, like six acoustic, a couple resonators.
Uh-huh.
I got a banjo guitar thing, and then all the other electrics. And there's kind of a mix between either Tellys, Strats, or 335s. Style, you know, like that. Yeah. I got a V, and
yeah, I see that, the white one right behind you.
Yeah, man, that's a very special guitar to me. It's actually an old Harmony.
Oh, wow.
From the 70s that the guys from Gibson loaded it up with Gibson stuff,
right.
And a friend of mine in Cincinnati painted it. He like does custom cars and stuff, so he painted it Cadillac pearl white, and I'm Cadillac guy. So yeah, so that's one of those few guitars that'll never leave.
Sure.
You know what I mean?
Sure.
And so I kind of bounce. Right now I have an endorsement with Vintage Guitars out of the UK.
Okay.
And I have an endorsement with Ciari Guitars. Are you familiar with them? Ciari, they're made in Nashville.
Ciari.
Stevens is pushing that right now.
Yeah, CIA.
Yeah, they fold up.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. And, and by the way, Ciari stands for Cock It and Rock It. C-I-A-R-I.
Yeah.
That's what he told me. That's what John told me. But and I got that, and then I have a endorsement also with Ferk guitars, which are out of Czechoslovakia.
Oh, wow.
And the Ciari and the Ferk are both travel guitars that fold up into a backpack. So they're great because when I fly overseas, man, I don't have to deal with anything like that. You know, I put it under my seat or up in the overhead, and nobody gives me any trouble about it.
Sure.
You know?
If you're going to go play, you know, are you playing tonight or?
Yeah.
So if you're going to go play tonight, what are you going to bring with you?
More than likely, I'll probably pick the Vintage guitar, which is it's a really, really, really cool. They put it together for me. Wait, this is it. Yeah. Hold on. Didn't know we were going to play Show and Tell.
Well,
but this, it's
a Telly style. Yeah.
But it's got a P90.
Yep.
And it's got a really nice whammy bar. Not a Bigsby, but a different kind.
Yeah.
I had them use the neck from the Revo series.
Uh-huh.
It's a lot nicer neck, and it's got binding on the side.
Yep. Block inlays.
Yeah, block inlays. It looks really cool. So I'm probably going to bring that. And then I recently... I've been wanting a Les Paul with F-holes.
Uh-huh.
You know, the older I get, the lighter I want my guitars to be. So I've been wanting one. Just didn't have it. They're kind of hard to find, you know. And some guy on Facebook Marketplace had this, you know, he had a Chipson, you know, the Chinese.
Yes, exactly.
And I'm looking at it, and... It's P90s and it's got F holes and it looks real nice. And so I called the guy and he only wanted $400 for it. Right.
Okay.
And so I'm like, okay. And then I said, well, man, I got some microphones and some old pedals and some stuff. I said, let me send you pictures of all this stuff. And if you want any of it, maybe we can kind of trade out a little bit.
Yeah.
Well, he took the mic and four or five pedals and something else. I think a DI box that I had like a it's like the most popular one. And of course, I can't think of it right off. But anyway, and he just said, I'll trade you straight up. And I go, okay. And it came with like a brand new Les Paul case too, you know? And so I said, okay. So then I took it to this guy that does some work for me. And I said, man, can you do a setup on it for me? I said, one of the knobs is kind of acting a little squirrely too.
Uh-huh.
So he checked it out. He goes, man, whoever had this guitar before you really did some upgrades. I go, what do you mean? He goes, well, first of all, he put all Switchcraft parts in it, and he upgraded your tuning pegs, and the pickup is a really nice P90. I can't remember which kind it was. And he said, man, you've got a really nice guitar here. And I said, cool. And the headstock had broken off at one point in time, and they glued it, and which that doesn't scare me because generally they're stronger.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
They glue, you know? And they tried to paint over it in the back, I think, to cover it up or something like that.
Yep.
So it's a little weird that way, but you know what? It feels great. It's super light. The things, man. I mean, it gives me just the right amount of sustained / feedback, uh-huh. you know, that I want, where it's not feedback, it's more sustained. Yep. And so more than likely, I'll probably bring it.
Okay. All right.
You know, and, but one of my favorite guitars, I got a reissue of the 61 Casino from Epiphone.
Yeah.
I was endorsed by Epiphone for probably 22, 23 years before, and then they got sold and I got orphaned.
Yeah.
I guess they didn't think I was famous enough to have.
And that's, you know, with the small humbuckers, right? That Casino?
No, the Casinos are P90s.
Oh, okay. All right. Okay.
Well, like it's basically the Lennon guitar.
Yeah. Yep.
You know.
Yep.
And I got that, and I just fell in love with P90s, and I've got them. I got P90s on probably 4 or 5 guitars now.
Okay. Wow.
And yeah, man, I really like them.
Yeah. How about an amp? What are you gonna? Do you have your amp like stored there permanently at the club?
No, I drag it around with me. Okay. Again, being older and wanting things lighter, you know, I read the reviews on the Fender Tone Masters.
Sure.
Right.
Yep.
And so I was like, well, that sounds interesting. I'll go check it out. And so I went and I checked out the Deluxe Reverb, because I've never been a fan of, I like the sound of the Deluxe Reverb, but I'm not really a fan of Twin. Twins to me are too mid-rangey.
Yeah.
They're just not my, it's just not me, you know.
Yeah. And they're heavy.
Well, heavy too, yeah. So I go and I pick up this Tone Master. I'm like, oh shit, it's only 23 pounds.
Yeah.
And so, I tried it out in the store, and I told the guys in the store, I said, look, I said, fortunately, there's not many people in here, but I'm going to crank this up to 4 or 5 because I need to see what it's going to sound like when I'm really getting into it.
Yeah.
Because how many times do you go to a store, you get an amp, and you get home, and then you put it on the gig, and it isn't what you thought it was going to be.
Yes.
Because you never really gave it a good shot, you know? So they let me do it. And so I bought it and I love it. And every sound man loves it because it's got that direct out. And
sure.
We figured out where the sweet spot on the direct out is. You turn it to 7 and put it on 2. It's got like a 0-1-2 slider thing.
Uh-huh.
I think that's like a simulator, probably speaker simulator.
Yeah.
And it's got that variable of the output. And it seems like, you know, we sat and played with it. It seems like 7 is the sweet spot.
Right on.
And, man, I you know, they start micing the amp. I go, don't mic it. Go direct.
Yeah.
And they're like, really? I go, trust me on this one. They do it, and they come back every time. Man, you were exactly right. And I'm like, anything that can get one less open microphone on stage and also one less thing I could accidentally trip over, I'm into it. Man.
And when you go to Europe, do you get backline gear or what are you using for amps there?
I've got a well, I almost didn't have a vintage. Nah. I've got some guitars over. I've got some stuff over there.
Okay.
I've got a Blues Junior amp over there.
Sure.
And I have one of those here for my backup amp.
Okay.
And I happen, the one that I got here, everybody who's ever played it, tried it, they're like, man, you got one of the good ones. And I bought it off a guy for $350, you know, used. But I've had 3 or 4, and this by far is the best sounding one. So, it's heavier than the Tone Master. It's got to be 35, close to 40 pounds. And that was 23. But so I got a Blues Junior over there. Is it a Blues Junior or is it the Junior Pro? No, it's Blues Junior over there. And then I've got an Epiphone like the 00.
Sure.
Acoustic.
Yeah.
You know, I've got that over there. I've got a vintage resonator acoustic over there. And then I've got the Casino Coupe, the Epiphone Casino Coupe, which is basically like the 339 size body.
Yeah.
335, but like the smaller body.
Yeah.
But with no block down the middle like a casino.
Okay.
So super lightweight.
Yeah.
And it's got the P90s.
Okay.
So I've got that over there. A friend of mine over there that hired me to do some stuff. One time I was over there, he goes, "Man, so what kind of guitars do you like?" And I go, "He goes, look, I'm going to buy you a couple guitars so you have them every time you come over,
right,
and
on.
I'll just keep them at my house."
Yeah.
And I'm okay. So I told him what I wanted, and he, you know, the two Epis he got, and I was able to get those for him like through the distributor kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
But then he found the Republic and I mean the Vintage.
Yeah.
And I didn't even realize it was made by Vintage.
Mm-hmm.
And then, like, three times after I got this endorsement with Vintage, I'm over there, and I pick the guitar up to play. I go, "Oh, shit, I have a Vintage guitar." I had one, you know? So it's pretty cool. But they stay over there along with that amp.
Yeah.
And I got a real small little PA system I can do a solo gig with over there if
wow.
I have to.
All right.
But almost all the stuff, you know, most of the venues, they'll provide yeah. stuff, you know. I'll bring the guitars. Yeah. When I just went to Spain, they provided all the stuff. But, you know, amplifiers, man, it's over here, anytime they provide backline, I just bring my own amp anyway.
Yeah, yeah, of course.
You know, because I can't tell you how many times you say that you want, you know, say you want a deluxe reverb or say you want a super reverb or whatever,
yeah.
and you get there, and for one reason or another, you know, they haven't maintained it.
Yeah.
The people have beat the mess out of it.
Yes.
It doesn't sound right, you know. And I like to play a lot cleaner. You know, if I go dirty, most of the time it's because I use the pedal to go dirty to dial it in. But one time my pedal board went out recently.
Uh-huh.
It turned out one pedal went bad.
Okay.
And so I just had my Deluxe Reverb Tone Master and my guitar. So what I did was I turned the Tone Master up to... Normally I play about 4, and I turned it up to like 7, and then backed my guitar down volume, and yeah. then whenever I went to do a solo, I bumped it up, and I was like, man, that tone sounds pretty daggone good, you know? It sounded better than it did with the pedal.
Yeah.
So I was like, you know, I've kind of been playing around with kind of doing a little bit of both.
Yeah,
you know?
Very good.
And I never really realized, huh?
And what are you using for pedals?
Cheap stuff. I'm the biggest fan in the world of cheap equipment, man.
Yeah.
If you can make it sound good, you know.
Yeah.
Because really, a lot of times it's in. But you familiar with those little Moore pedals?
Uh huh.
Yeah. Like all my pedals, my pedal board is only, it's like the small pedal train thing.
Yeah.
I've got like 8 pedals on there.
Uh-huh.
I've got the mini. I got the baby crybaby.
Sure.
The mini crybaby.
Yeah.
And then all the rest of them are mini pedals. So okay. I've got a. What's those one pedals? The one pedals are actually really good. Equal. it's a brand name, and they make some really good pedals. But it's basically just a clean boost, you know, a smooth boost.
Yep.
Really just kind of warms it up and everything. And then I've got Moore's version of like a tube screamer.
Yep.
And then one that they call a pure boost, which is a cleaner. Boost, and then I've got their tremolo pedal,
mm-hmm.
Which I use that for like a slow tremolo, and then I use the amps tremolo for fast.
Yeah.
And then I've got a chorus pedal.
Mm-hmm.
I got an octave pedal I just use occasionally,
uh-huh.
like on, if I'm playing Johnny Guitar Watson Real Mother for You, I'll use the chorus pedal, the wah-wah, and the octave pedal. For just the solo parts, it just gives it a real funky,
yeah.
crazy kind of sound, you know.
Yep, yep.
And then I've got a digital delay.
Okay.
And then I the one regular size pedal I got is a B. It sounds like a B3. What's it called? B9 or B2 or something. It's a I can't remember who makes it, but it's about that big. But
sure.
it sounds amazingly like an organ.
Okay.
You know,
cool.
Crazy.
Are you always using the same guys in the band?
The guys in my band have been with me over 2 decades.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah, my drummer's been there 26 years.
Damn.
Both. I have a 5-piece that I run right now.
Okay.
We do drum, bass, guitar.
Uh-huh.
Keyboard player, also plays trumpet, and then a sax player.
Oh, right.
So we've got the horn section.
Yeah.
And, you know, he goes between electric and acoustic piano on like a Nord and a B3.
Okay. All right.
And then he has, when we're on the road, if they don't provide a B3, he's got like, you know, the portable version, which sounds pretty good.
Yeah. You know? And what about if you go to Europe? Are you taking those guys with you? Or are you?
No, unfortunately, I'm not known enough for them to front that many plane tickets. So I go and I do probably 2/3 of the shows will be solo acoustic.
Okay.
Which I really enjoy doing.
Yeah.
You know, and then the other ones, they'll put a band behind me. I had in Spain recently, we just did it as a trio. So I had a drummer and a bass player that I met like the day that we played, you know. But I sent them files. They did a really good job.
Oh, good.
They were kind of really more heavy metal players, which kind of scared me at the rehearsal because, you know, I said, well, let's just do this. Let's do Stormy Monday. We'll do 1-4-5, and then we'll do some passing chords. And the guy just starts charting it out. And I'm like, dude, it's 1-4-5, you know, and he still wanted to chart it. He just wasn't familiar, you know, with the terminology, and it wasn't familiar with that type of a structure of a song.
Sure.
And so I was really, you know, I called the guy back from Gibson that kind of put me over there. And he goes, how'd the rehearsal go? I mean, I said, I'll be honest, man, I'm a little nervous, you know. And he said, I'm going to put my faith in these guys, you know. Yeah. And then we went and did the show, you know, and I did everything I could to put the bulk of it on my own shoulders. And they stepped up, man. They really did a great job.
That's great.
Then we went to a different city. They did a great job again.
Right.
And they ended up being really nice guys and helping me navigate, you know, transportation and stuff. And we've kept in contact. And I told them, I'll come back again, man. And I met some other guys over the place. And then the band that played with me in Scotland, they played with me like 4 different times. And they were great.
Yeah.
The one kid was bass player. He was like 22. I was like, dude, you come to the States, you get a job. He was so good. You know, he's so good. There's just great musicians everywhere in the world.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Yeah. For sure. Yeah. And how about, do you ever do solo shows here in the States?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I do solo tours. You know, I'll go do maybe 8-9 days somewhere. The most recent one I did was I went down and did like 7 days in Puerto Rico.
Okay.
Which is kind of the States, you know.
Yeah.
But and then I got 4 or 5 days coming up in, when is that? It's in August, the 1st of August.
Okay.
Up around the D.C. area.
Okay.
And these are, a lot of these things are combinations of I'll do a venue.
Uh-huh.
And then I'll do maybe a small winery.
Uh-huh.
And then I'll usually grab 1 or 2 private house concerts.
Sure.
Which I thoroughly love doing, you know, and they're really cool to do because like I got these one people in D.C. and they're both musicians themselves, and they're willing to do a house concert on a Monday.
Oh wow!
So how cool is that?
Yeah, you know, it's like, exactly.
It's like I got, you know, I think the last time we were there, I did the Groove in New York City down in the Village. Uh-huh. On the Sunday, and then went down to D.C. and did their thing on the Monday. So it just really worked out great.
Yeah.
And they were such nice people. Man, this guy had more instruments than I did, all stuck in his room. He had like that big old Mexican whatever it is that you try to play it, and the body's all the way
up. Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I was like, how do you play this thing?
The bajo.
Yeah. Is that what it's called?
Yeah.
Yeah, right.
Do you manage yourself?
Sure.
You do?
Yeah. At this point in time, yeah. I did forever. A few years back, I went into a management deal with a guy. I think we made some really good inroads the first year.
Uh-huh.
And the second year, it kind of got stagnant and it got a little frustrating.
Sure.
for both of us. We still talk.
Uh-huh.
But we walked away from it, you know, like, you know, I just kind of said, it just isn't working for me anymore.
Yeah.
And we both said in the very beginning, if it stops working, you know, just be honest about it.
Yeah.
You know, and don't be weird. Just, you know, give me a chance. If something I'm doing bothers you, give me a chance to fix it. And if I can't fix it, just tell me that, hey, it's not working.
Yeah.
And that's kind of what we did, you know.
Okay.
And he's kind of more – more into the booking part of it now than management. And so I just told him, I said, man, you know, if there's anything that you can shoot me, you know, I'm more than happy to pay the commission. You know me. You know I'll always show up. You know I'll always be a pro.
Yeah.
And you always get, you know, good responses, you know, good reports from people. They always want me back.
Yeah.
And you know that I always do the right thing. You know, if you get me on a gig, you know, I don't go behind your back the next year try to book it on my own. You know, it's like I do what you're supposed to do. It's like, no, give Dennis a call.
Yeah.
You know, and even if they want to talk to me directly, I'll be like, that's fine, but he's going to issue the contract and you're going to send the deposit to him, you know. But the best thing he ever did was he convinced me I was worth more than I was asking for.
That's good.
And that was good. That was good.
That's valuable information.
Yeah. Yeah. And it worked out okay.
Yeah.
You know, and because you know how it is, man. It's like somebody says, man, will you come play for me? And you're like, okay, I'll do it. You know, and you know, they're kind of your buddy, but not really. But, you know, they kind of go through that. And I was always under pitching myself. And then I would do something, you know, I'd tell somebody a price. And they'd instantly say yes, and I'd go like, well, I underbid that one. Right? You know? Or I'd do a price, and they'd sit there. I mean, I literally have had – I can't tell you how many people have said, man, that's too cheap. Let me pay you a little bit more. And I'm like, well, I won't tell you no, you know.
So
that was part of the process. And I think a lot of musicians probably have that problem.
Yeah.
Because, you know, it's easier to – I tell younger ones, they're talking to me, and I said, look, you have to realize, you know, not only are you an artist, not only are you a person, the whole thing, but you are a commodity that is being marketed and sold, okay? So you're no different than a bottle of Heinz ketchup next to a bottle of Kroger ketchup. What is it about you that is going to set you apart from the one next to you?
Yeah.
Can you find something that sets you apart? And if you do, you know, can you show that you know, your ingredients are equivalent, and, you know, and if they're charging X amount and you feel like you're in that same ballpark, you ought to be charging X amount, you know? And it's not really that simple, but in a sense it is.
Yeah, of course. Are you booking the shows in Europe too?
I booked some of them. I've made enough contacts that the thing about the club that I play in Nashville, it's literally like going on tour every night without leaving home. 70-80% of the people in the audience are from somewhere else.
Yeah.
I always start my show. How many people from out of town? Man, everybody. Woo! You know?
Yeah.
And probably 5-10% are from another country.
Uh-huh.
Just because of the nature of Nashville, of people coming to visit, you know, and tourists and business travelers and everything else. So I've made a lot of contacts, and so, you know, I know if I'm going to Germany, that I know that I've got 4 different people in Germany that I might be able to pick a gig up with. Same thing over in the Netherlands.
Yeah.
And now it's starting to happen in England.
Oh, right on.
And Scotland. And so, like, on this particular run, there is an agent that I'm working with over there.
Uh-huh.
And so I'm doing, like, the Birmingham Jazz and Blues Festival. And I've always done the Edinburgh Jazz and Blues Fest in Scotland, which is wonderful. I'm waiting on my dates for them.
Uh-huh.
But there's this other agent that I ran into that he's got me 2 gigs in the London area.
Oh, right.
And 1 outside in Kent. And then I called this guy that I knew, and he was able to get me a Tuesday night somewhere.
Oh, right on.
You know, it's not going to pay a lot, but, you know, he says I can crash at his house, and I can, and I'm playing for whatever the door brings in, and the place only seats about 65 people. And if I can get 40 people there or 50 people at, you know, 22 pounds, which is kind of the normal going over there.
Yeah.
You know, and then sell a little merchandise. I've got a stash of t-shirts over there. And
oh, right
CDs,
on.
And then I bring some with me.
Yeah.
And so, you know, because I try to travel light. And so, you know, all of a sudden that Tuesday night that I would have had to pay for my hotel and sit there doing nothing, you know, maybe I walk away with 700-800 pounds, you know, after expenses or whatever, maybe more. Maybe it helps pay for that flight, you know.
Yep, that's decent. That's definitely decent.
Yeah.
You mentioned your Cadillac. You're a Cadillac man. What do you have as far as Cadillac?
Well, right now I have 2. My everyday driver is like an 08 DTS, and I found it. It only had I found it about 6 months ago. It only had like 65,000 miles on it.
Okay.
And it looked like it just came off the showroom.
Right on.
And so it's in beautiful condition. Everything's fine. I just put new tires on it and brakes, and that's it. And oil changes. That's it.
Yeah.
Then I'm in the process of redoing a 1969 convertible.
Oh, right on.
And this is my third one of those.
Oh, my God.
And my fourth 69, the last. And then 3 or 4 years ago, I was looking for a convertible, and I found a 65 Sedan DeVille that only had 70,000 miles on it.
Oh, my God.
The price was okay. The interior was in great shape.
Yeah.
The body was straight as could be. And so I bought that, redid it. I had about 17 grand in it when I was done.
Uh-huh.
AC worked, everything. It was a beautiful car. I even put the gangster walls on it, you know. And some guy came, and it was parked in front of the club. Some guy came, he goes, "They tell me that's your Cadillac." I said, "Yeah." He goes, "Well, I'm sure it's not for sale." I go, "Man, everything's for sale. Come on." And so he offered me 25, and I took it.
All right.
So
all right.
Actually, for the first time in my life, I actually made money on a car. But really, the only reason I was willing to let it go was I had really been looking for a convertible.
Uh-huh.
And it was a four-door hardtop. And I really liked it. It was a great car. It was beautiful. You know, I've got it in. If you look at my video on YouTube of the song "What I Feel,"
yeah,
that's that Cadillac.
Oh, right on.
Yeah. So, but it just wasn't the one that I wanted.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
See how this one gets done. You know.
Yeah. Exactly. Well, Stacy, it's been wonderful speaking with you. I appreciate your time. If you ever make it out to the West Coast, I wanna shake your hand in person.
Oh man, I would love to. Yeah, I come out every once because Eddie, one of the guys, you know, he lives out there in Van Nuys.
Okay, I'm up near San Francisco.
Oh, you're up there. Okay, well, I get up there to some people that I've become pretty good friends with, but they've hired me to do 3 house concerts.
Okay,
they're in Pleasanton.
Oh, right on. That's
is that close?
That's about 45 minutes away from where I am.
That's not bad.
Not bad at
all. That's closer than Nashville.
Yes.
Yeah, man. Well, man, I'll tell you what. The next time they call me to come out that way, I will touch base with you. We'll grab lunch or something, okay?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you, Stacy.
All right. See you soon. Okay.
Have a great day.
I will. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Thanks for listening to Have Guitar Will Travel. You can catch up on all the things I'm doing at thedeadlies.com, and I'm on all the social media platforms as well. And please support Vintage Guitar and all the wonderful things they do, because they do many, many wonderful things for us guitar players. Thanks. Please subscribe. Please tell a friend, and I'll see you guys next week. Bye, guys.